parenting doesn't come with a manual, and when your child learns differently, there's no one size fits all. Here, we think out the box. We celebrate every unique mind, every different path, and every win, big or small. Welcome to Out the Box, where kids and parents grow together.
Good morning, and welcome to Out the Box. For minds that don't fit the mold, but hearts that keep striving. I'm Simone Herring. Today, we're going to be talking about a topic that touches so many lives and so many families, but is so misunderstood: autism spectrum disorder, or ASD. According to the World Health Organization, and I do stand to be corrected, around one in every 100 children worldwide is autistic, which means autism is something that many of us will encounter through our children or our grandchildren, through children that are at school with us or friends or colleagues even. For some of us, the journey begins with a mild or tiny little, you know, milestone that has been missed, and that we're not aware enough of what that should mean, or do we look at it as milestones that are just a little late or delayed? For others, autism means that speech and social interaction and behavior isn't quite right. And for many of us as parents, it starts with that quiet kind of tingling feeling that something is amiss. So how do we know when to be concerned? And what are the early signs or red flags of autism? And how is autism diagnosed? And perhaps most importantly, how can we as parents or grandparents, aunties, uncles, support our children to navigate this journey that is so fraught and so terrifying, but with hope at the same time? Joining me today, this morning, is Ilana Gershlovitz, mother, author, educator, and autism advocate extraordinaire. Her book, Saving My Sons, is a deeply personal account of raising her three boys on, not all, but two of whom are on the autism spectrum, and the lessons, the challenges, and the triumphs that shaped her family's journey. So drawing on her personal experience and professional experience, Ilana is going to help us unpack autism, separate the fact from the fiction, and answer some of the questions that sometimes we're a little too scared to ask. So whether you're a parent, grandparent, teacher, therapist, or simply somebody wanting to understand autism, stay with us for what promises to be an insightful and truly inspiring conversation. WhatsApp your questions. We'd really love to hear from you today. And I put this question to you. Have you ever had concerns about a child's development, communication, learning, or behavior? We have Ilana here, trapped in the studio with us for a whole hour. So please send your questions and your thoughts to 061-895-1019. Ilana, welcome to Out the Box.
A treat to be with you today.
I must say that I read your book in one Shabbos from beginning to end. And as I said to you, I cried. I cried throughout the book for your pain, for other parents' pain, when you just made it so tangible for us and so real to understand. So I want to start with the story behind your book, The Journey of Autism. And we need to clarify some terminology before we do. So along the way, we'll do the same. As I said before, it's such a personal account of your family's journey through autism. And I think that firstly, for parents putting themselves out there is something that is extremely confronting. You're exposing your deepest fears. So why did you decide to write the book?
The day we launched the book, which is actually 6 years ago, I said to my husband, Martin, I can't speak. I'm petrified. And I must say he encouraged me to tell the story And he's always been my behind me and my biggest supporter. And he said, of course you can tell the story. And we wrote the book because we wanted it to be a guide so that we can help other parents. And we wanted other professionals to truly understand the makeup of autism because there are so many misunderstandings around the diagnosis.
Misunderstandings and misconceptions. And I have to just tell all our listeners that Ilana started off as a lawyer. And isn't it remarkable that she brought so much to South Africa from America about autism and built her own schools, both the Star Academy and Catch Up Kids. So I think it's fascinating how mothers become such important advocates for their children. And that's what leads us to there, because all we want is to understand our children's behavior. So your eldest child was diagnosed, and in the book, you know, what was really, really, really emotionally difficult for me was that he never said, Mommy. Can you start with how that unfolded, and then let's move into what an autism diagnosis actually means. What is autism?
My little baby, David, my firstborn, was born perfectly normal. He had normal development up until the age of 20 months. And then all of a sudden, we saw a regression. He lost his eye contact. He stopped responding to his name. And he became unreachable in his own world. This unfolded in a week. We were running from one specialist to the next, looking for answers. And I say in the book that I'll never forget the fateful day the doctor delivered the diagnosis. It felt like a final judgment. Goodbye and good luck.
That goodbye and good luck gives me shivers, and I have them now. Because how devastating a diagnosis. And then, sorry, you know, you're on your own.
Make him comfortable. Take out an insurance policy. Yes, you can do a couple of therapies. Oh, and you happen to be pregnant with your second child. Not much we can do, unfortunately. I'm so sorry. My next appointment has arrived.
Gosh.
That is how we received the news that our son had this terrible diagnosis of autism. And autism is a terrible diagnosis, Simon. It is not a superpower. The children are not all Elon Musk. No matter where you are on the spectrum,
exactly.
It is a challenge.
And I say that all the time. I say that dyslexia, ADHD, none of these learning barriers or these disorders are superpowers.
Now, worried moms do better research than the FBI, right? And
yes.
Especially Jewish moms. Like, this was my baby,
yes.
Hey.
Yes.
And I don't take no for an answer. Like, when we go to Woolworths and we want a size 10, but they don't have, then you'll be like, but maybe at the back they have.
Yes.
So this is my child. And the doctor said, he's not going to speak. She actually said those words. He won't go to school. You can give up on your hopes and dreams for his future. You should know now. And really, I don't think at 20 months of age, any doctor should put such a ceiling on a child's development. She certainly couldn't look into a glass ball. Nobody can. And that's where our journey started. We were absolutely devastated. We were gutted. We fell on the floor and cried. I always say the Indian Ocean has water because it contains my tears. I cried oceans of tears. It was a very, very bitter time. We were a young married couple. Life happened at a very young age. We had to hold it together. It was very gut-wrenching. I used to fall on the floor and hide in a dark cupboard on the floor. And I used to just ask Hashem, please, please give me cancer. Let me die. Anything. Just save my child. There was this beautiful little boy with his blonde locks. He was so perfect. And I was told he wouldn't speak. Is that possible? That somebody is not going to have language, a way to communicate, a future? I wasn't willing to accept that. I don't generally take no for an answer very well. But
I think that is a superpower, not being willing to take no for an answer.
When somebody tells me no, I tell myself they said maybe.
Exactly. And I think that's what people misunderstand, is that the fact that you keep going and that you face up to what you've been dealt with. That's the superpower.
Well, a doctor, and we were talking about this doctor just now, Dr. Rodney Unterslag, who was very loved and well-known in the Jewish community in Johannesburg, helped me with David at a very young age, and he taught me that Hashem created the cure before the illness. And this concept pushed me forward. And, you know, David's 23 years old. I didn't cure his autism. I certainly hope and pray and daven for a cure every day of my life. As I said, it can be a terrible, debilitating diagnosis. We have made David into a functional and independent boy who has a quality of life because of all the years of therapies and medical treatments that he's received, and we'll talk about that. And my youngest, who was also diagnosed on the spectrum, did make a 360 recovery. So I don't have two kids on the spectrum. I have one kid. And, you know, when people say, oh, your youngest lost his diagnosis. Oh, no, that's not possible. He didn't have autism to start. Oh, no, people don't recover from autism. Well, they absolutely do.
Unbelievable. And he has no traits, Ilana.
He has no traits.
That's incredible.
What recovery means, you know, we work very closely with an American organization. At the Center for Autism and Related Disorders, my academy, the Star Academy, that's been established for 20 years, has collaborated with the Center for Autism and Related Disorders. Their head office is in California for the last 20 years, and they have really, really developed curriculum and methodology of teaching for children across the spectrum that really ensures results. And they defined recovery. They published papers in peer-reviewed journals on recovery from autism. Recovery means that the child is in a mainstream school with no facilitation. They have scored average to above average on the IQ, and they have been re-diagnosed by a medical professional as not presenting with enough criteria. Now, I have to just quickly jump in there and say a lot of teachers at our Jewish schools today are very quick to say, oh, spectrum stuff is on the spectrum.
But isn't everybody, Ilana? You know, you have one little trait and then they go, oh, he's got the TISM, or he's, you know, called aut.
It's really, I think, that we need more education around this, because you can have a bag of developmental skills deficits. You can have social skills deficits. You can have some executive functioning skills deficits, but that doesn't necessarily put you on the spectrum. So I think we've got to really talk about this. And yeah, so my younger son does not present with a criteria for autism.
So we're talking to Ilana Gershlovitz, and we're just going to do a little bit of housekeeping, and we'll be back.
Out the Box is brought to you by the South African Jewish Museum. Preserving our past, celebrating the present, and inspiring our future.
Welcome back to Out the Box. Today we're speaking to mother, author, educator, and autism advocate Ilana Gershlovitz. Ilana has chronicled her family's extraordinary journey through autism with a book that she wrote approximately 6 years ago. So we're going to dive into now the specifics of what autism is, but Ilana is going to weave her personal story into this as we go along. So stick with us and you'll learn much, much more than the drips and drops that we get about autism spectrum disorder. So, Ilana, the question is, what exactly is ASD?
It's defined in terms of the DSM-5, the Diagnostic and Statistics Manual. On the one end of the spectrum, you can have a child who's nonverbal and can't speak at all, unresponsive to, if you call their name, they don't respond. On the other end of the spectrum, you have a high-functioning individual who can be at university, who maybe did get married, but they have social skills deficits, they struggle with perspective-taking. And so, Simone, we really are comparing apples and oranges on the different ends of the spectrum. over 10 years ago, they changed the diagnosis of autism. So we used to have categories before, remember?
I read about that, yes. And I remember, I think it was Tony Atwood who spoke about Asperger's.
Yes, and we had the different boxes. And
the PPO. What was
PDA.
Yes.
And it was a big mistake to put it all onto one spectrum, because the need for services on various ends of the spectrum really, really differ. My 23-year-old profoundly autistic son means that I'm a caregiver, given not a parent, and he needs more access to educational services and medical research to try and find more treatments for autism. And then on the higher functioning end of the spectrum, they advocate for acceptance and inclusion. Mm. Now, absolutely. And at the same, you know, it's just very different needs. Mm. And in America, they're working towards changing the definition. It really confuses parents. When parents receive a diagnosis of autism, some of them think, okay, but my child would just land up like Elon Musk or like The Good Doctor, that movie. You
know. And Rain Man. I mean, wasn't that the first introduction to people? I mean, and that he's got these savant abilities.
We find very few savants. At the Star Academy, we got little kids, 3, 5, 7, screaming and crying because they can't speak. Can your listeners imagine something like this? You know, children on the spectrum can struggle to motor plan speech. They don't choose to be nonverbal, they have a physical impediment. Mm. My son David could not motor plan speech. You know, I flew to America, I found experts in speech motor planning, I brought them to South Africa, I flew them to South Africa for many years to train our staff here, and we have very, very unique tools to work with children who are nonverbal and who have speech motor planning impediments. This goes beyond a little therapy once or twice a week. We're talking about it requires intensive one-on-one intervention on a daily basis, and my heart breaks them on, because we get the kids when they're 5 and 7, and you know, we really need to get them at 2 and 3 when early intervention is key and really does matter. But just quickly to get back to the diagnosis, so in America they are working towards changing that diagnosis, and it is going to change because it confuses so many people.
Also, the correlation with ADHD, I mean, I've experienced, you know, as a mom, I've gone to a few different psychiatrists and neurologists, etc., as one does. and a lot of it was confusion between ADHD symptoms and autism symptoms. But maybe we'll continue with that a little later when we get into the nitty-gritty of it. So as I said before, you know, the Rain Man movie, and we speak about the savant and these extraordinary abilities, and that very few people do have it.
Very few.
Yeah.
One in, I can't give you a number, but it's extremely rare. It's not common.
No, not at all. And what really got me in your book was how much time and energy David had to put in each and every day.
He had to work really, really hard to do those things that come naturally to typically developing children. And my youngest, Aaron, you know, he overcame all those challenges. He's a miracle. Hashem said yes. You know, sometimes the answer is no, and sometimes the answer is yes. Both times I davened, I screamed at God, I demanded it, please save my boys. You know, we human, we want our children to talk, we want to hear mommy, we want to hear I love you, we want to know where they want to go, what they want to do. With David, the silence was deafening, my heart was broken, I was so afraid of the future, I was so fearful. When parents go through this kind of diagnosis, it's very terrifying.
And Ilana, you spoke about that at 17 months, Aaron, who is your third son, he had an ear infection, and he went to get grommets put in. And when you were leaving the hospital, Eli said to you, "Mommy, why isn't Aaron looking at me?" That must have been terrifying.
It was absolutely terrifying. I can still remember Ellie's my second. He's actually
Ellie, I apologize.
No, that's fine. He's 21. So David's 23, he's profoundly autistic. Ellie's 21. He had typical development. Hashem honestly had mercy. Baruch Hashem, he's typical development.
I was studying medicine in Cape Town.
Yes, he's in fourth year. You know, he spoke very early, but he walked at 23 months. just for all the Jewish moms listening. Okay. And people used to say, take him for physio and take him for OT. And I didn't take him for anything because he was talking, you know. So Ellie could never kick a soccer ball.
Right.
And he could never knock a ball over the net. But the boy ended up studying medicine, so he
incredible.
Made up for it.
Incredible.
But yes, getting back to the story, you know, Aaron went in with eye contact. He had some words. And he had an anesthetic they gave him on the day, nitrous oxide. I think people are familiar. Nitrous oxide is what you get when you go to the dentist.
And that's the mask.
Yeah, that's the mask. So a young child, they don't like to give them intravenous anesthetic. They gave him a mask with gas. They prefer that in younger children. And we saw an immediate change in Aaron. He came home and we lost him. And it did take Martin and I a couple of weeks before we would really admit it to each other. Like, come. We've lost him. He's lost his speech. This is not right. He's not okay. We are seeing autism unfold for a second time.
So was there a time after that anesthetic where you were asking yourself, as you say, you didn't face it immediately, but what were those signs that you could have put down to maybe something else, but actually they were signs of autism?
Right. So look, he started spinning the wheels of the car, which is a very strong sign of being on the spectrum. If we talk about red flags in a young developing child, and we can talk about them. I think the biggest thing for me with Aaron was that he just stopped talking. Mm. He went in and he had single words and he came out and he went silent. Mm. So that was really frightening. And he became very hyperactive when we used to see him run in a circle. So you're like, he's just experimenting. Right. Kids can run in a circle.
Right.
But he was running in a circle too much, you know. So yeah. If we talk about red flags to autism, are they flapping their hands, walking on their toes? Have you seen a regression in language? Do they continue to develop their language? Peter pointer, you want them pointing by 18 months. You want, you know.
So pointing to something that they want, or, you know, they want to go somewhere. So they kind of, even like take your face, turn your face sometimes and then point you
in
that direction.
The pointing is very important because a lot of the parents who consult with me, and I consult with many parents who suspect an autism diagnosis or whose child has been diagnosed with autism, but they'll say to me, oh no, but he hand leads me for communication. He'll take me to the fridge. That is not communication. Mm. Peter Pointer shows communicative intent and is a pre-verbal skill.
Okay. Very important. And then the other very important skill or red flag when there's a lack of it is imitation.
Yes.
And it took me a while to get my head around it, because imitation on one hand is a milestone and we expect children to imitate. And on the other hand, it can be a red flag for autism. So can you explain the difference when it is a milestone and when it is a red flag?
Simone, I am so glad that you mentioned that. That is one of the most important red flags when you are, you know, trying to determine, okay, is my child just a little bit slow developmentally, or are we looking at red flags to autism? Imitation is absolutely essential in a young developing child. By 9-10 months, a child should have imitation skills that start to develop. Clap hands, wave bye-bye. Mm. We speak because we imitate. We have social behavior because we imitate our peers, we imitate our parents, and in about a third of the children on the spectrum, they're lacking imitation, and that has to be taught. So David, my oldest, and Aaron, also my younger one, he lost his imitation skills. He was imitating. So again, we were talking earlier about if you had a typically functional 7-year-old and suddenly they stop talking or they lost skill, we'd be rushing them to the clinic and booking them in with a million doctors to try and work out like what happened here. But we have this ridiculous label called autism that the medical professionals think that they can just give to a 2 or 3-year-old who suddenly regresses and loses skill.
Yes.
How can we say nothing happened?
Yeah.
Something pushed that child over the cliff.
Yeah. So that brings me to the question, and we were speaking about it earlier, the difference of when something is neurodevelopmental and when it's neurological. But I just want to go one step back, Ilana, because I just wanted clarity on this. Imitation. You know, sometimes you find a child who keeps repeating what you've said.
Mm.
And also if you say, what's your name, the child will go, what's your name, what's your name, what's your name? And that doesn't resonate as in what's your name is a question and now you give me the answer. So can you explain that type of imitation before we get on to the neurodevelopmental?
Yes, I'm happy you raised that. So that's called echolalia. There is a percentage of children on the spectrum who present with echolalia. I always tell their parents when they consult with me that they have a better prognosis because at least they can imitate 50% of the battle won. But they still have language deficits. In order to speak, there are many developmental skills that need to come together for that little child or individual to have a conversation at their level, at the expected level. So we need language content, language comprehension, language fluency, a bank of words to draw from. We need motor planning. And so children on the spectrum can have different developmental skills deficits. And so their language skills are not fluent. It's not polished. It's not an oiled machine. And so once we start delving into the language domain and into the motor domain to go and see where their deficits are, we start unraveling the reasons that they've developed echolalia, but it is a blessing that they can imitate. It is much easier to work with a child who's got echolalia and tap in and meet them where they're at and then move that language to functional communication. We do that a lot of the time. You can teach them functional communication.
Right. And that's because they have that verbal ability. Am I correct?
They have the motor planning.
The motor planning.
You 100% spot on. Yeah. My son David couldn't motor plan. Why? Because when we speak, the brain signals the muscle for speech. There's
right.
actually signaling between the brain and the muscle. And between the facial muscles relies on signaling from the brain to the lips, to the cheeks, to the muscle under the tongue. It cues the muscles of the face to produce consonants and vowels for speech. So Mon David, at 5 years old, there wasn't signaling from the brain to the muscle. I had flown to Austin, Texas when he was 5 years old, put him on a plane, off we went, and we found a very special technique, you know, that I brought back into South Africa. We trained actually a lot of speech therapists over many years in this, and as well as our staff at the Star Academy, and it's to touch the muscles of the face to prompt the consonants and vowels for speech. So it's almost like if you've been in a car accident and you need a whole team working with you. Like, let's say you've been in a car accident and the doctor says, look, okay, with rehabilitation and what you need physio and you need reflexology and you need it, I'm booking you into rehab and we're going to massage your legs and every day we're going to help you stand up and then put one foot in front of the next. That was Aaron, hey? That was my youngest. He lost his motor ability for speech. We were in big trouble and we knew we were in trouble. Mm. We worked with him every single day, 7 hours a day. Aaron is a miracle. It was like he was in a wheelchair, having come out of a car accident and couldn't stand up. That's how I can compare his speech.
Yeah, I mean, I found that so alarming that you can undo the autism diagnosis. And can we speak then? Can we take it into the neurodevelopmental and neurological? So I was recently on a course and one of the professors who speaks about ADHD showed that in the temporal lobe and in the frontal lobe of the brain, you could actually see that it was smaller than in another brain that is not ADHD. Is it the same for autism?
I love that you asked that question. My son David had an MRI too. They didn't find anything. At 11, he had an MRI. It came back completely normal. In 90% of kids on the spectrum, it does come back normal on a basic MRI. And I remember thinking, oh, my goodness, he's 11 years old. He can't speak. He has epilepsy, and the MRI is fine. Like,
and
somebody,
how is that even possible? You expect to see, you know, an injury on the – like damage. You expect to see damage on an MRI.
Of course. And just looking back now, I mean, David's 23. How could we not have access to professionals who are doing scans beyond – an MRI, you know. And so when David was 21 years old, I was approached by a neurologist who specializes in cancer. He operates on cancer patients, removes tumors, and then he brought in a special laser technique to try to repair the brain if there's any damage after surgery. And he was very interested in David's case, and he asked if for autism he could do a study to see if the laser would in any way help David's brain to regain certain functioning. And he did a special MRI, and Simone, that shows you the networking in the brain. And when we saw the results of that, he showed that David had underconnectivity, overconnectivity, and in some areas no connectivity. So with autism, we're looking, it's really the main frame of the brain is usually intact. It's the connectivity.
Right. Is that the pathways? Is that the neural pathways that that you know would send information from your brain to your speech, for example?
Exactly, and that's why early intervention is key, and that's why therapies that address the child's issue once or twice a week is not is going to fall short.
Right.
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
Whether you're a parent, caregiver, au pair, or grandparent, a child's safety is in your hands. But when an emergency happens, will you know what to do? At the Hatzolah Training Center, the First Aid Essentials for Children course gives you practical skills to respond with confidence. Visit hatzolah.co.za and book your course today. Hatzolah, a moment of learning, a lifetime of living.
Get down to the Bluebird Shopping Center now. Let us be a part of your journey with your little one and give them all they need with great savings on big brands. Experience a wide range of baby products for every precious moment, from bath time to bedtime and meal times to play times. Baby City has your needs covered. Head to Baby City Athol at the Bluebird Shopping Center for everything you need, from South Africa's leading baby hyper. Baby City, we know you care.
Out the Box is brought to you by the South African Jewish Museum. Preserving our past, celebrating the present, and inspiring our future.
Stay connected with everything Chai FM across all your favorite social media platforms. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube at 101.9 Chai FM. From the latest news and community updates to competitions, behind-the-scenes content, and everything in between, there's always something happening on our pages. Hit follow, turn on your notifications, and never miss a moment with Chai. Welcome back if you've just joined us. We're having the autism spectrum disorder conversation with mom advocate, author of a book, you know, mapping out her experience of autism with her children. And Ilana, before I get into the next question, I just want to tell the listeners, because I was blown away when I first said to you, okay, so where is David now? And you said to me, David loves to cook. And he's a chef and he works in a kitchen that makes food for poverty, you know, poverty-stricken people. So can you just tell us very briefly, because I think that's the most magnificent outcome.
Yes, so David received 20 years of a certain educational instruction called Applied Behavior Analysis, ABA. ABA is a methodology of teaching rooted in psychology based on positive reinforcement. And because he received this intervention, we could teach him to follow a recipe, to cut with a sharp knife, to peel vegetables. And so he works in a kitchen that we set up for him. Best of everything, of course, McGovern.
Well, I think, you know, it speaks to how fantastic you are, that you so, and I know parents are, and we all are, just so invested in our children. And I think it's so wonderful that you set up this kitchen for him.
It really does give him a purpose. He gets very excited to set his menu on a weekly basis. And he has one of my staff every day, you know, with him in the kitchen. They cook soups and stews and pizzas, and that we feed homeless people, single mothers. And it's very meaningful to see David smile when we give these homeless people the food on the side of the road. They actually know him very well. And they, when we drive past, he says, they'll say, my chef, where's my chef today? Where's my chef?
Wonderful. Everyone wants to give back. Everyone wants to be useful in mm-hmm. life. Mm-hmm. And we can't just say that children that are on the spectrum are just going to be, that we don't encourage them to do things that are within their scope of being able to do it. And that's why it brings me to this question of the DSM-5. The DSM-5 is a diagnostic and statistical manual of mental disorders. This is the 5th edition, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
It's the guide that health professionals use worldwide in order to diagnose autism. And in 2013, it changed, as you mentioned before. What I want to ask you is, when somebody diagnoses autism, how is it done? They look at the features. Does it have to be a certain amount of features? Does it have to be more age-related? Can you open up that for us?
There are different levels in the DSM, so there are different levels of severity. But then essentially they look at three areas. Social skills, does the child or individual present with repetitive behaviors? And then they look at language and communication. If you are language delayed, and significantly language delayed, you're going to be automatically socially delayed. Mm. If you have skills deficits in general, you're going to end up developing repetitive behaviors because that's how you control your environment.
So that repetitive behavior, Ilan, I'm sorry to ask you in the middle of what you were saying, but I think it's important for the listeners to understand. That repetitive behavior, is that a child playing with toys in a different way from a child who doesn't have an ASD diagnosis?
Typically developing children will take a car, put the people on the car, take them to the shops, wash the car. A child on the spectrum is going to line them up and then will be staring at the line and make the cars into a straight line. They'll take all the utensils in the kitchen and pack it into a straight line. So they're playing abnormally. They haven't developed functional pretend play.
And do they become distressed if that line is changed or moved or?
Yes, and that's a flexibility issue. Or they build a tower with Lego and it's in a straight line. And then if David used to do, people used to come over and then he used to order us on the patio in a certain configuration. And if anybody moved, he'd have a meltdown. How's that for?
And that meltdown, I mean, I think, you know, when one is in the shop or one, you often feel so judged that people look at you and they say, well, can't you control your child?
Well, Ellie, who's my middle son in the book, and his voice is in my book as well as Martin's voice, and he always said that when he used to go to the shops with me and David, it would be like walking next to a ticking time bomb. Yeah. You know, it was a matter of time that David would just blow up. Mm-hmm. And I always used to say that we used to stand in the old lady's queue, senior citizen, and yes. Then the old ladies used to tap me on the shoulder and say, excuse me, why are you standing here? And I'd be like, in 2 minutes, my son is going to show you why.
Yes, yes. There is just a lack of awareness. I have a WhatsApp here, and it's actually a WhatsApp, interestingly, nice. From a husband.
Wow, nice.
So I'm quite excited that the men are also listening to the show. It says, morning, Simon and Ilana. My wife and I have a little boy who was diagnosed with autism a couple of years ago. Even now, my wife still blames herself. She keeps asking if she did something wrong during pregnancy, if she missed the signs, or if there was something she could have done differently. I've told her so many times that it's not her fault, but she still carries such a huge amount of guilt. What would you say to parents, especially moms, when you're a husband and the moms are struggling to let go of feelings like this, Ilana?
Her feelings are very normal. I also felt guilty. In fact, I punished myself in the early years because I felt guilty. I thought it was something that I did. So what she's going through is a very normal reaction. In fact, I wouldn't buy new clothes. I couldn't look at myself in the mirror. Mm-hmm. I only realized years ago that I was going through the Jewish phases of mourning. Think about it, because we cover the mirrors and we wear flat shoes and we sit Absolutely. On low benches, and I'd go lie on the floor in the cupboard. So yes. I didn't want to eat. Yes. I could go 3 days without eating. I wanted to punish myself because I did feel guilty. As a parent, your automatic go-to is that you feel that it was your fault. I hope that this father is listening. please tell your wife that it was definitely nothing that she did.
Yes.
How autism develops is there's genetic vulnerability that comes into contact with environmental triggers, things that you cannot control, and then the child regresses into autism. But to give them hope, and hope is the best medicine of all, right?
Of course.
Autism is a treatable medical condition. There is a medical treatment protocol. There are educational interventions, and the child can get much, much better.
So My little two cents worth is, please contact Ilana and she will help you. She will help you navigate this whole journey. And the Star Academy are, you know, on Google, and you can look up the number, and please, please call Ilana. Ilana, so I don't think we really answered fully that DSM-5 diagnosis. It mentioned two different things.
Yes.
I mean, I can't exactly remember what it was. It was...
it's the repetitive behaviors, it's the language delay, and then we've got the social skills delay.
Yes.
And then there's different levels of severity.
Yes, yes. And that was what struck me, is that, like you said, it's on the spectrum. And it's hard to imagine that a child can be totally not nonverbal and then another child be... so verbal and functional, like they speak about low functioning and high functioning. It's bizarre to think that could be. Either you've got cancer or you haven't. Either you've broken your leg or you haven't.
I love how you've described it. You know, people will come to me and say, the OT didn't want to say he's got autism, but you mentioned maybe. We went to the doctor and he said, it's too early. You must come back when he's 3.
Mm.
We can diagnose at 18 months. You either have autism or you don't. It's exactly how you said. You have cancer or you don't. Mm. You have the flu or you don't.
Mm.
You know, whenever somebody suspects autism, that's what it is, autism.
So interestingly enough is that I've met a little 3-year-old. And she doesn't speak English very well. She's learning how to speak English. But if I say to her, what's your name? She says, what's your name?
Mm-hmm.
Is that – we're going to go to an ad break quickly, but just keep that in mind. I'd like you to answer that question.
Well, that does indicate that she has echolalia. She needs to comprehend language and answer appropriately. So that could be one of the signs, but we'd still have to look at it in context.
Right.
Out the Box is brought to you by the South African Jewish Museum. Preserving our past, celebrating the present, and inspiring our future.
This is Out the Box, and you're listening to Simone Herring. I'm having a conversation with Ilana Gershlevitz about autism. Ilana, just quickly going back, I asked you the question of a child who doesn't know English very well and is learning. She's 3 years old and she's also imitating. For instance, I would say, what is your name? And she would say, what is your name?
Mm-hmm.
Is that because she doesn't understand, or is that what you were saying, is that echolalia?
It could be echolalia.
Echolalia.
Echolalia, yes, which means that you're just repeating whatever somebody says to you, but you're not engaging in functional communication. We would have to look at her comprehensively. So when we do an assessment of a child to determine if they are on the spectrum, we look at social skills, motor, language, adaptive, academic, executive functioning, cognition, play skills. And so we'd have to assess all those developmental areas. You know, we can't just look at like one thing and say definitely,
yes,
but it's not a great sign.
Okay. So, as you were saying, we have to look at all the different kinds of things that we're seeing in order to make the diagnosis. So, a parent who may think that their child is autistic, what does that look like? Where do they go first? Who do they speak to initially? And then, you know, how does a comprehensive autism assessment begin?
Excellent questions. In a young developing child, the parents should go to their pediatrician. If you are concerned about an autism diagnosis and you've started researching it, it means something's off with your child. Mm. Rather be safe than sorry. Go on to Google, download the MCHAT-R checklist for autism. It's the global recognized red flags to autism list, the MCHAT, C-H-A-T-R. The MCHAT-R, and take that list to your pediatrician, book an hour consultation with a pediatrician and say, help me make a diagnosis. Mm. In South Africa, there are very few pediatric neurologists, and what tends to happen is that the parents are standing 6 months in queue in line to speak to this pediatric neurologist or developmental specialist. If you were worried about a mole on your arm that could maybe be cancerous, could you wait 6 months to see a dermatologist?
I know, it's insane.
It's actually unacceptable with what's happening in the medical profession that they think that the parents can wait six months to, when it's something as serious as possibly autism that needs early intervention.
I was just going to say that, especially that early intervention could make such a big difference.
It sets a stage for the outcome and the prognosis. So I encourage parents not to wait for a developmental specialist. By all means, make that appointment, make, you know, that neurologist appointment. But in the meantime, go to your pediatrician so that they can help you. We haven't even got enough time and now forgotten about your other questions. You're going to have to remind me, but I want to talk about psychiatric medication and that not being first line treatment for a child on the spectrum.
Okay, Lana, you've got like Craig is already like waving at me.
Oh, so, my goodness.
You know, we are going to have another episode next week, which I'm so thrilled about. But quickly, can you tell us about that before we end? You've got like a minute about the medications.
Okay. All right. So I'm so happy we can quickly talk about that. We know for certain, and this is fact, this is not opinion, that there's a gut-brain connection in autism. We know that the children have immune issues and metabolic imbalances. We know that children on the spectrum struggle with detoxification, methylation, mitochondria. There are many medical treatments treating inflammation, the immune system, and metabolic imbalances that can successfully treat the symptoms of autism. Psychiatric medication is definitely not first-line treatment. They have serious side effects. I'm not saying there's no place for psychiatric medication. There certainly is after you've exhausted all other avenues. But in South Africa, we tend to go to psychiatric medication first, and this is a big concern.
Right. We are definitely going to pick that up in our episode next week. As we come to the end of today's conversation, the one message that has really stood out for me is that autism is not about limitations. It's about understanding, acceptance, and recognizing the unique strengths and potential within every individual. Ilana has so kindly brought three books. If you can send me the name of the book, then you win it. So please send in the name of Ilana Gershlovitz's book, Her Journey with Autism. When you've met one person with autism, you've met one person with autism, says Dr. Stephen Shaw. I'm going to leave you with Gloria Gaynor, I Am Who I Am, and Ilana, thank you, thank you, thank you.
Thank you.